Okay, so I'll be talking about deeper into K-theory. And this is the first of, well, probably three lectures by physicists that seems to be about the right number to cover the material. Maybe a fourth, we'll see how it goes, to develop the physical setting for K-theory. And my lecture and the next are based on Witten's paper of the same title. Now, actually, most of my lecture is going to be a minimum introduction to string theory. So, to tell you just as much string theory as you need to know to see why K-theory is important to us. Well, to start with, there are three relevant string theories. There are actually five string theories plus one other, and maybe some will appear indirectly, but there are three relevant ones, and I'm going to explain why those are relevant. And they have the unexciting names of types 1, 2a, and 2b. And the minimum information that you need, I think, is the, I'll tell you what the massless states are. And to what the brains are. And then I'll develop some properties of these brains. And by the end of today's lecture, I'll explain just a little bit as to why K-theory appears in the classification of the brains. Now, first of all, the idea of a massless state. So in string theory, we're talking about, again, taking little one-dimensional objects and quantizing them. And when you quantize them, then it's basically a superposition of harmonics, and each harmonic is like quantizing a harmonic oscillator. And so you get an infinite tower of states. The more excited the string is, the heavier they are. And for a lot of the structure, you can see it in just the massless states. And so, in fact, the first thing that I'm going to do, I'm not going to derive anything at this point. Again, to try to derive anything would be many, many lectures. But I'm going to describe for you the massless states of these three string theories. And again, massless means that if you have, well, from a physical point of view, if you have low energies, these are the only ones that you excite, or if you're looking at distances low, if you're looking at space-time distances which are long compared to the size of a string, then the only states that are relevant to the physics are, again, the massless ones. So I'll make a list. Let's start here. First of all, let's start at field. So, okay. So I'm talking about massless states over here, but then via field theory, each state is associated with some field, and it's easier to use the language of fields. So in particular, there's the metric. And I'll list which of these theories appears in, and all string theories have gravity in it. So this appears in all of them, type 1, 2a, and 2b. And that should have another label, sector. And part of this is just establishing terminology, and I'll explain this terminology later on. And then we have some potentials. And again, I'll explain what I mean by potential shortly, but these are fields which are actually differential forms, anti-symmetric tensors, and which ranks of form appear, depending on which string theory you're in. And And already you see hints of Bach periodicity and a relation decay theory, which is actually what you're seeing there. And then there's some more potentials, which are given a different name. And these appear, only in the 2A and 2B theories. And then one more field that appears in the type 1 theory, an SO32 gauge field. Okay, and again, it would be a long story to tell you how this comes about, but again, each of these different string theories, I'll give you some hints about where the word is later, but each of these different string theories involves a string which is moving not just in a physical space, but a superspace of different types, and you quantize the oscillations, and when you reduce to just the massless sector, you find, depending on which one you're in, some of these fields. Now, let me say what I mean by these potentials. Again, the potential is the rank n differential form, and it is a tensor, and it's a generalization of electromagnetism, so the gauge invariance. Delta of Cn is the exterior derivative of an n minus 1 form. And so since d squared is 0, we can make an invariant field strength Fn plus 1, which is d of Cn. So for n equals 1, this is electromagnetism. And that's basically n equals 1 is pretty much all it fits in four space-time dimensions. But in fact, the various superstring theories have these generalized gauge fields. And again, which ones they have depend on which string theory we're in. Let's see, a few more refinements here. First of all, to be precise, there are some nonlinear terms in each of these, which are known as Chern-Simons terms. These will not appear directly in anything I say. They'll appear indirectly. They may appear more directly in the third lecture. I'll explain a little bit more the distinction between the first two lectures and the third. There's another set of potentials which I'll explain a bit more terminology shortly, but for whatever reason are generally denoted with a different letter, but again, it's the same idea. They're two-form potentials, they have a three-form field strength. And one more fact, again, which won't appear directly, but it has some indirect consequences, and again, it may show up in a later lecture. These potentials, or more precisely, the corresponding field strengths, are not all independent, namely the one with n indices and 10 minus n indices are basically the same. It's 9 minus n, right? Okay, so star is just the dual on forms. I don't have to define that, do I? Or do I? Yes, should?
Probably not.
Okay.
9 minus, is that
9 minus? 9 minus, because it's n plus 1 is 9 minus n. So this is
okay.
10. Yeah, the sum of the numbers is...
Yeah.
I'm sorry about the n plus 1 and the 9. Yeah, I should have marked so I said n and... Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So as it happens, these are not independent, and there again, there are important physical consequences, but they won't appear in anything that I say or that we said probably next week. I don't, but by the third lecture, this fact might matter. And similarly, these two field strengths are dual to one another. Okay. Now let me explain this terminology. NS is Nouveau Schwartz, and R is Ramon, and each of those names appears doubled. The point is that all of these states come, again, from these closed strings here, and in a closed string, one can actually separate the internal degrees of freedom into the right movers and the left movers. The string has some orientation. And in fact, the Hilbert space is approximately a product. So the space of all states is approximately a product of the state, all possible right-moving states times all possible left-moving states. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but it's close enough to the truth. And in particular, now the terminology comes out as follows. All of these fields are just ordinary fields, you know, basically taking real values, and so they correspond to bosonic particles. Okay, they're not fermionic particles, where these would be some kind of, you know, Grassmannian algebra, right, because these are just ordinary, you know, real fields, metrics and tensors and so on. So they're bosons. But now here I'm getting a boson, so I'm getting a bosonic state as a product of two other states. And I can make a boson either out of, because fermion number is something which is conserved mod 2. Okay, so all particles in physics is this mod 2 grading, and there's the ordinary ones and the fermions. Okay, so these bosons can be obtained either as a boson times a boson, or as a fermion times a fermion. And for historic reasons, this is the one that's called Nouveau-Schwartz, or just NSNS, because Nouveau and Schwartz discovered this sector, the bosonic sector of the string Hilbert space, and this one is called Ramon's, because Pierre Ramon's discovered this sector of the fermionic sector of the string Hilbert space. Now, in terms of the technical machinery of string theory, these two kinds of states have some rather different properties, and so there's a lot of emphasis in the literature on whether a state is from this sector or from this sector. Let me editorialize actually later on, but that's where the terminology comes from. And again, since we're not going very deeply into string theory here, this really isn't going to matter. But what will matter is that these Ramon potentials and the associated brains have some specific simple specific properties. Oh, by the way, you might ask, well, how about states in which I have a boson times a fermion? Or a fermion times a boson. Indeed, those are in there too. So I can get fermions either from fermion times boson or boson times fermion. So in fact, I've listed here only the bosonic fields. And these are, again, all the ones which are most, well, it seems surprising to say this since there are symmetries that relate these to these, but in some sense, these are the ones which are most important. These are the ones which have a classical limit anyway. And these are the ones which sort of where you see the, which are relevant. Okay. Oh, by the way, there's one more here. There's one more here, namely the two type two theories have only closed strings. And in fact, the way they differ is that in the Ramon sector, in the sector where the states are fermion times fermion. There's a choice of chirality, which again is similar, I think, to things you've seen with spinners. Similar to chirality with spinners. In the string spectrum, there's an analogous choice of chirality, and depending on whether the choice is that the two halves of the string have the same chirality, that gives you the 2B theory, or the opposite, you get the 2A. So the type 2 theories are theories both of closed strings, and they differ in the relative chiralities in the Ramon states. And that's why you see the difference then in their Ramon context. The type 1 theory has several, two actually complications. One is that it has both these closed strings and these open, and there's a further projection on the spectrum, but I'll leave that for probably Simeon next week, because he'll be talking about type 1 theory in much more detail in the context of K-theory. But anyway, the same story with the open strings, and with the open strings, you get, in the type 1 theory, a gauge field. And this is actually a special case of a much more general Pfaffian string theory that will gradually develop. Okay, so that was the first half of what you need to know about string theory, which is the massless fields it has. Any questions? I tried to avoid jargon that I haven't defined, but it can never be sure. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot one. It's not going to matter, but here, there is one here. There's a dilettante. Excuse me. And it's just a scalar and thanks. And good. And that's in all three string theories. Okay. Now, the reason I went through this is because the next fact, the interesting fact is, that all of these potentials couple naturally to objects, and for every potential that appears in a given theory, so does the corresponding object to which it couples. So, in particular, if we have potential, I'll leave some room here, Cn couples naturally to an n minus one dimensional object. That's because an n minus one dimensional object, as it moves in time, sweeps out some n dimensional world volume, call it W. So W is this object, its history. Its history in time defined submanifold of space time, and it's n dimensional because the object itself is n minus one dimensional. And so then there's a natural coupling, an action in the sense of dynamics, which is attained simply by integrating the potential over the world volume of the object. And so for each of these potentials with some rank, there is a corresponding object of dimension one less. I figure whether to say things in. Okay. So actually, let me start. B2, a two form, a couple to a one dimensional object. So one more column is the corresponding brain to which they couple. B2 corresponds to a one dimensional object, which is the fundamental string itself. That is the string that we originally quantized when we were talking about all of these fields. So it's an ascended object, and it couples as it should to a two-form field. So actually, you might think now we're talking about string theory in a limit where there are two kinds of string. There are the little tiny quantized strings, which we're working with as very small, and we don't see the internal structure, and we're just keeping sort of the massless states of that. But then in addition, we might have what's more like a cosmic string, something which is very long and sort of visible to the naked eye. So we're managing some sort of limiting process in our mind where we're separating the spectrum into two bits. And that's just for the purpose of this introduction, not because, well, it's just for the purpose of sort of this introduction to string theory. Similarly, the sixth form couples to a five-dimensional object known as the NS5 brain. And the NS is the same NS in the potential. And now the CNs couple to what are called D brains. And again, the N form couples to an N minus one dimensional object. And let's explain what these things are. Let's start erasing. So again, I already told you that the one-dimensional object there is the string itself. The NS5 brain is a soliton. That is, it's a localized solution to the field equations, like a, well, I'm sure you've seen these in other contexts. Localized solution to the field equations. With some topological stability. In ordinary quantum field theories, we have these two basic kinds of objects, the quanta themselves, the basic point quanta in that case, and solitons that are built out of coherent states, out of classical field configurations. In string theory, we have this third kind of object. And its distinguishing feature, again, I'll draw its rolled volume, is that ordinary string can end on it. Okay, so in the type 2 theory, I told you that we had only these closed strings on endpoints. But in the presence of one of these objects, in fact, the strings, which are, here's one of these strings over here, and away from the object, it can attach to the object in this way. It can break open. It can now be an open string, but with its endpoints on the world volume of the D-brain. Now, in the history of this subject, one first sort of had the perturbative machinery for quantizing these things and discussing their interactions. And there's a sort of roundabout indirect argument for understanding why these objects actually also have to be in this theory. I'm not going to go through that because it's a long detour. It's sort of through a property called T-duality, which won't figure directly in anything that I'm going to do. Again, it might come up by the second or third lecture, and if T-duality comes up in the second or third lecture, then at that time it might be possible to explain, you know, how one deduces the existence of these objects. Anyway, that's what they are. As I tried to indicate by the figures, the D-brains, I really should have two colors of chalk, one for sort of strings. They should be in blue, and the D-objects should be in green color. Okay. It really would be better if I had colored chalk, because, again, I'll dash the ordinary strings, and I'll leave the D-brain solid. Now, as I tried to indicate by the figure, the D-brain has to be a closed. This is a picture of the D-brain in space and time. But now let me focus, just for convenience, on the state of the D-brain at one time. And there's its shape, and again, I've drawn it as one-dimensional, but again, it can be, as you see from the table over here, it can be two-dimensional, three-dimensional, and so on. And now you might ask, can the shape of this object be any submanifold in space-time? So this object defines some submanifold in a space-time X. And you can ask, what kinds of shape can it have? And first of all, it has no boundaries. Okay, they aren't allowed to end. So they have to be closed manifolds, but they don't have to be compact. So a D-brain could be like a sphere like this, but alternatively it could stretch from sort of one side. It could be closed but non-compact. It could be sort of a line that extends from plus infinity all the way over there, all over there. So the only rule at this point is it has to be closed. It doesn't have to be compact. Secondly, it has to be so. Running out of space. Oh, you don't need all these anymore. So, Y is closed. It also has to be orientable. And The reason it's the orientable is because it has this natural coupling to these forms, and obviously this makes no sense if the orientation changes. This thing is only defined if the object has an orientation. So from the existence of this coupling, you don't have to be orientable. Actually, this coupling also tells you that it has to be closed because we had this gauge invariance. And the variation, of course, integrates to zero. That's why this is a natural coupling. But it integrates to zero, again, only if the object has no boundary, only if the object is closed. So the fact that there's this coupling, and again, what a coupling means in physics is simply that if I have some process where, well, the object is moving through this field, then there's an action associated with that. There is, I think, one other condition which I can't describe now, but will appear probably at the beginning of the next lecture. It won't appear. I can say the words. It has to be spin C. Closed orientable and spin C. Apparently the C is down or up. And why it has to be spin C will appear again later on. Okay. Figure out where I am. Good. Okay, so that is the introduction to string theory. And the main point so far is that string theory has these forms that live in space-time. And it has these objects, these brains that couple to the forms. And so this naturally suggests that these things are classified by cohomology, surfaces and differential forms. And in fact, the reason that we're here is because they're actually classified by something a little more intermediate, which is K-theory. The most immediate physical consequence of this is the following. This listing of the brains is not complete. There are brains which do not couple to any of these forms, but which exist. They correspond to the Z2 elements, the torsion elements of K-theory. And these play an important physical role in various bits of string theory. So the main point, I think, of this lecture and the next is to understand why K-theory appears, and in particular to see then that it leads to all the objects that we've described here, but also then to these additional Z2 valued objects. The third lecture will be probably about the fluxes themselves, that is explaining why these fluxes are really not differential forms that have a similar global subtlety associated with the fact that they are something in K-theory and not in just differential geometry. Okay, so let me just, from everything I've said so far, just store a list of the brains. Oh, I'm sorry, there's one, now I should make my editorial comment. Which is that from henceforth, we're only talking about the D brains and not these objects. That means in terms of the potentials that we're only talking about the Ramon potentials and not the Debye-Schwartz potentials. Now, it's interesting because the distinction between this kind of object and this kind of object is crucial in string perturbation theory. It's crucial in this semi-classical limit that we often describe the theory in. And in fact, all the constructions that I'll be describing are really constructions in that semi-classical limit. In fact, we now, through these dualities, have an understanding of string theory in the strongly quantum regime. And in particular, in the Stirling quantum regime, the distinction between these objects and these objects disappears. There are symmetries, transformations, which relate these to these, and there's no physically invariant distinction between them. Which certainly suggests that there should be something bigger and better than K-theory, quantum K-theory, that classifies the full set of objects, but I don't know if anybody has any idea what that is. So, okay, we're talking about then the D-brains. And then again, in 2A, so now I'm going to use an integer P, which is the dimension of the object, which is compared to what I had, n minus 1. So the P brains, for 2A, P is anything even, all even values. For 2B, P is odd. And for type 1, P is 1, 5, and 9. So to explain why K-theory appears, I need to develop some additional properties of the D-brains. And so that's the next part of my lecture. The properties that I want to develop are their degrees of freedom, B, again, more about their action. I told you a little bit about it over there. C, properties of coincident brains. And D, brain, anti-brain annihilation. Okay, so once I've developed these, then we'll be in K-theory. Any questions so far, or any jargon again that's going by too fast?
What is the law of the electron fiber?
It's the D5 brain evil twin. What's the role of any of these things? It has properties which are less simple than the properties of the D-brain, and that's the first thing to say. In some sense, the properties of the D-brains can be understood completely from some kind of semi-classical limit of string theory. The properties of the Bose-Schwarz-Fine brain are much less clear in that limit because a D-brain is a simpler object than a soliton. And if this is a soliton which has some kind of quasi singularity, which is not a physical singularity, but a singularity in description that makes it hard to see all of its properties. At some level, again, I told you there are symmetries that interchange the NS5 brain and the D5 brain. Actually, they also interchange weak and strong coupling. So those properties, which are sort of invariant under changes in the coupling, are the same for the two objects. And that includes a lot of things many of the things I'll tell you about D5 brains also hold for the Bose-Schwarz-Fine brains. The Bose-Schwarz-Fine brain has been a focus of a lot of interest because it's a notch more complicated than anything else we've described. And there are lots of things there that just aren't fully understood. That's pretty much all I can say. It's probably one of the more complicated objects in the subject. Maybe I'll think of more. As we go along, maybe I'll think of more to say about it. Okay, degrees of freedom. So, let me start again with a single D brain. I'll sort of draw a sphere here, a spherical-ish thing here. And the first and most important thing is there's a U1 gauge field living on it. Okay. And that shouldn't be a surprise, because K-theory is about gauge fields on submanifolds. Now, here's my submanifold, and so not surprising there's a gauge field living on it. There's a, okay, what else does it have? Well, its shape is a degree of freedom. It's a dynamical object, so it can wiggle. So its shape is a degree of freedom. And then, because, again, string theory has fermions, there are some fermion degrees of freedom, which won't play a direct role, again, in anything I say, but may later on enter indirectly. Okay. By the way, again, just as those C fields weren't really differential forms, this is not really a gauge field, and possibly that will be explained later on. It's really, again, a spin C structure, but that's not important here. Locally, it's just a gauge field. Where do all these things come from? Well, they come from the same place that those metric and other closed string fields came from that I named. Namely, this is a D-brain, so it's a place where open strings can end. It has these little open strings attached to it. You, just as for the closed strings, you quantize these, and now we're picking out from all of the states of the open string just the massless ones. So these are the massless open string states. So just as space-time itself gets its dynamics from the metric, which is a closed string state, these objects get their dynamics, their shape, and other things from the open string states attached to them. Okay. Okay, and this, the U1 gauge field, which we'll see a lot of, since it's field strength, it's a two-form, okay, so this is an ordinary U1 gauge field, a two-form field strength, and I'll put a tilde on there just so there's no confusion with the Ramond-Ramond. So this is to distinguish this thing which lives on the brain from the Ramond-Ramond field strength that one has of various types. So the same letter F, but it's a different object. The other one lives in space time. This one is just lives on the submanifold where the brain is. Okay, B, the action. And again, I'm not writing the whole action. These objects have kind of kinetic action, which, you know, governs their motion, F equals ma in the sense of Newton. But then they also have this action for their coupling to the background field, and that's the only one I want to write. And now I want to refine what I wrote before. So again, it's integrated over the p plus one dimensional world volume of the swept out by the objects. But now here's the full action. Okay, and I'll expand this out to make it clearer what the notation means in a second. But before I expand it out, these are again the Ramond fields. These are the world sheet field strengths. And these again are these Nevot-Schwarz two-form fields, and I'll set these to zero. They won't play a role. So now when I expand out the exponential here, the first term is just what I had before, the coupling of the p-dimensional object to the p plus one form potential. But in addition, it couples and of course the sum terminates because these are differential forms and they have only so many indices that fit. But what you see is that when this internal field strength on the D-brain is non-zero, when this gauge field is non-trivial, then this gauge field, in addition to coupling to the potential that kind of defines it, It also couples to lower rank potentials, which are the ones that ordinarily couple to lower rank, lower dimensional brains. So in fact, physically what you can think of is that when the field strength is non-zero, then what you're describing is a bound state of the P-brain with lower dimensional brains. So this is a really interesting and important fact that the that there's this gauge field and that it has this physical consequence. Let me leave that there for now. Okay, so that was the second property that I needed. So the degrees of freedom and then the action, the effect, how they appear in the action. The third is what happens when you take several D brains to be coincident. You're going to probably need about four colors of chalk. Okay, so here's again a DP brain, and now let me take several of them coincident. So this is N coincident DP brains. Well, the first and most important thing that happens is that the U1 gauge field becomes a UN gauge field. So in other words, living on this surface, so again, I'm calling the shape of this surface Y, it's saying we have an n-dimensional complex vector bundle on Y, right? That's just saying we have a UN gauge field. Call it curly V. So instead of just getting N, this is again one of the distinguishing properties of these D brains. Instead of getting simply N U1 gauge fields, one on each D brain, you get an N by N matrix of them. And where this comes from is, again, these gauge fields come from these open strings, which attach to the D brains. And if I've got N D brains, then an open string, one end can attach to any of those N, and the other end can attach independently to any of those N. So I have N squared, where I previously had one state, I now have n squared states, and not surprisingly, what's happening in the gauge structure is that it's a UN gauge field. This is not going to matter. When I listed the degrees of freedom of the the degrees of freedom of the D brain, the first is the gauge field, the second was its embedding in spacetime, its shape, or its fluctuations, which would live in sort of the normal bundle, right? The interesting thing is that the fluctuations also are also elevated to N by N matrices. So they're elements of the normal bundle. Right, the normal times the adjoint representation. That is the homomorphisms of V into V, I guess you'd say. But the basic thing is that it's where I have here N coincident spheres, and so one's ordinary intuition would say I have N independently fluctuating shapes. But in fact, those N collective coordinates are actually elevated to an N by N matrix. And this, in fact, is non-commutative. So it's non-commutative geometry. It's isomorphic to other. It's related to other appearances of non-commutative geometry in string theory. There are connections I know between non-commutative geometry and K theory, which aren't going to be the subject of my lecture or the next, and probably not the third one either. I don't know if there if maybe there's a fourth lecture to be given here, because I don't know the subject well enough. But the reason that this won't play any role in anything that I say today is, as far as I'm concerned, all of my D-brains are going to have some fixed shape. Nothing I talk about will deal with these fluctuation modes of their position. They're going to do something, but they're not going to move anywhere. So these fluctuations, for anything I'm going to say, are frozen, but they do have this curious property that they have this larger structure than you would ordinarily have for classical objects. Okay, so that's the physics coincident brain. So now we have submanifolds of space-time with UN gauge fields on them. So we're getting closer to K-theory. But K-theory has one more thing, which is you subtract bundles from bundles. And so that's what comes next, brain anti-brain annihilation. So let me draw here. I'll draw here a non-compact, infinite flat D brain, because it's easy to draw. So this is some kind of DT brain. And next to it here, I'm going to draw an anti-DT brain. Okay, what's the difference between a DT brain and an anti-DT brain? Well, the difference is the orientation. Let me try to keep these things from running into each other. The DT brain, as I've already said, has an orientation. So if I take this one, take another one like it, and turn the second one upside down, just rotate it, it becomes an anti-DT brain. And you can see some of the significance already, since the DT brain couples in an oriented way to this potential, this one couples in the opposite way to the same potential, with the opposite sign. And so if I take these two things and put them right on top of one another, they have no net coupling to this background differential form potential, this background Ramon potential. So it suggests that, well, if I have a D brain and a coincident anti-D brain, that it's something very much like the vacuum. It has no charge. And in fact, it can decay to the vacuum. Okay, I'll draw that in a second. I don't want to get too fast here. I mean, I hope this isn't mysterious in any way.
If you just take the DT brain and were to rotate it, for example?
Just were to rotate it. It would become an anti-DT brain.
It becomes an anti-DT.
That's all that is. That's all that is. Yes. Well, shortly I'll explain. It's a relative difference. If I have just one here, I can't tell you which it is because it's, you know, a convention. But the convention would come from the sign of the coupling. So if I establish a convention that a D brain couples with a plus sign, you know, I've got to pick some orientation to my manifold. And if I establish a convention that a D brain couples with a positive sign, anti D brain couples with a negative sign.
But if in perturbation theory, you say that D brain is
you'll see this very explicitly shortly. It shows up in what's called the GSO projection. Okay, good. So let me draw a picture which shows you this thing turning into the vacuum. Let me imagine these are very close together. And let me draw the following, where a sort of a throat appears. And this throat is allowed by the orientation because you see it folds back on itself. So you can imagine that these are very close together, some kind of quantum fluctuation would turn the DP brain into DP right there. It would allow a hole to develop, so it's now just one connected surface. But once this develops, it can expand. And it's energetically favorable to do so. It's turning potential energy of brain into kinetic energy of expansion. And this thing can basically expand to infinity. So once a hole develops, and you've got to trust me that could happen, once a hole develops, there it will just expand and the entire thing disappear. And again, that can happen because they have the opposite orientation. If they have the same orientation, I couldn't draw these pictures. Because again, what's conserved is that if I go from the top to the bottom, I pass through a net of zero D-brains, and that's conserved before or after the decay. Now, there is another way to describe this process, which is closer to K-theory, and it's also the answer to the question that was asked about what's the difference between D-brain and the anti-D-brain and perturbation theory. So, let me consider. I told you what happens if you have N coincident DT brains. Let me now ask what happens if I have N coincident DT brains. And again, it's always useful to start by thinking about the infinite flat ones and not have to draw them. Okay. So I have N coincident DT brains, and then M on top, right on top of them, anti-DT brains. Okay. Now, the strings that give them their dynamics have M plus N places to attach. Each N can attach either to one of these or to one of these. And so to first approximation, initially it looks as though, let me say this as following. I'm going to describe the spectrum by first describing too many states and then a projection that reduces you to the correct number. And this is a construction that often appears in string perturbation theory. It's actually not something which has some invariant significance. It's something which, again, is an artifact of the way these things are described, but it's very useful. So I'm going to describe too many states. I'm going to describe a U N plus M gauge field. And then also the fluctuations are in the, again, they won't matter much, but be complete in the normal direction in the adjoint representation. And then, in addition, there is something else. There's a tachyon, which is a scalar particle, just a function, but it's in the adjoint of Un plus N. Now, what it means to be a tachyon, I'll explain shortly, but before I explain what it means to be a tachyon, I first want to tell you about the projection that that reduces this spectrum to the actual spectrum. And again, this is called the GSO projection, and it really is something which has no deep physical significance, but is an artifact of the way we describe things. So I'm going to define an operator. And it acts with an overall sign on each of these fields, and then it has a separate action on the matrix part. Well, I'll try to explain. Okay. So it acts as this is positive on the gauge field. And on the fluctuations, I'll just call them X, and negative on T, the tachyon. However, in addition to this overall sign, it acts on as the n-dimensional identity and minus the m-dimensional identity on the vector index, the vector index carried by all these things. By the way, this vector space is called, this vector index is called a Chan Patton, index. Just a bit of terminology. But let's just see what this projection does. Well, each of these fields was an n by m matrix, but now let's see what's left over. So we have our m I'm sorry, our N indices from the NDP brains and our M indices from the MDP bar brains. And now, for the gain for the vector potential, I get an overall plus. And so the components survive that either both in this block giving me two plus signs, or both in this block giving me two minus signs. So up here I have the vector potential surviving, and also the fluctuations that I'm calling S. But because the tachyon has an overall minus sign, the only components that survive are those which are in the off-diagonal blocks, which get one plus sign and one minus sign from the action of minus one to the F on the matrix. So here we have T, and actually all this stuff is permission, so that's T dagger for what it's worth. Okay. So this is the spectrum of this system, and you see that here's the difference. Here's the way in string perturbation theory the DP brain and the anti-DP brain are different. They differ in this projection. They differ in this projection, and in such a way that I get a UN gauge field on the DP brain, a UM gauge field on the anti-DP brain, and what connects them is just this tachyon field. By the way, I could do this totally differently. I could just start with the N plus M DP brain, actually follow the spectrum as I rotate and turn M of them around. They get a completely different description, but leads to the same end point. Okay, what is a tachyon? So, a tachyon is a field with a scalar with a negative mass squared. Now, what that means in practice is the following. It's a field, and there's a potential energy associated with the field. And because the mass squared is negative, the potential is an unstable potential. So this is potential, and this is T. Okay, so the state that one begins with, the state that one constructs a theory around, is an unstable state. The tachyon wants to roll down the hill. Now, these tachyons appear in various places in string theory, and sometimes they're pathologies. Well, what do they signify? Well, first of all, let me point out that if I only had the N D brains, and M equals zero, if I had no anti-D brains, if I only had the N D brains, I only have this block up here, I have no tachyon, I just have gauge fields, everything is fine. So a system that only has these N D brains is stable. Good. And in fact, the GSO projection, one of its significances is that it removes the tachyon from the spectrum when we open, in the absence of, well, anti-D brains, for example. Now, however, if I have both the D brains and on top of them the M anti-D brains, I have this tachyon, and I have this potential, and the tachyon wants to roll. And is that a bad thing? Well, in fact, it's just another description of what we've already seen. I've already told you this configuration is unstable against little holes opening and expanding. And the tachyon rolling down the hill, believe it or not, is in fact the same phenomenon, an alternate description of the same phenomenon of what the tachyon rolling down the hill describes is this process sort of happening everywhere at once. That's not obvious, but in fact, one has many examples where one has kind of a controlled description, and you can see that where a tachyon appears, it's associated with some physical instability that you can identify by other means. Now, in some cases, one doesn't know where this process ends. But in this case, we do. We don't know where, one doesn't know where it ends, and one doesn't know whether it ends. But here, we know where it ends. Let me suppose that n is greater than or equal to m, for sake of argument. Then on physical grounds, the only place this can, the place this will end, the place where, which has the same quantum numbers and no instability, is to for these things to annihilate to the maximum extent and be left with just n minus m dp brains. So in this case, one knows that this instability should be a local property of the potential, and there is a lower bound because there is, well, there's a limit to how badly this thing can, to where, there's a limit to where this thing can go, a lower limit, and so it had better be this potential actually turns up. And the minimum here describes the maximally annihilated state that I've drawn over here. Like that. And remarkably, this has been made quantitative in the last few months. Much of this construction is due to Sen, by the way, Ashok Sen. And he in particular, a great deal of it, he in particular showed that you could, in string, using the machinery of string field theory, this is the first time it's actually been used to do something that couldn't be done by other means, using the machinery of string field theory, you could follow this process from here to here and see, in fact, that the endpoint had all the right physical properties of the state that you expect to end up with, the right energy, the right degrees of freedom. It's a remarkable thing. Okay. I've actually gone 10 minutes over, and I've noticed that you all have...
There are 5 minutes. I'm not watching the event.
8 minutes. Okay. Let me then just, if you don't mind, spend 10 more... Okay. Let me spend 10 more minutes setting the stage for next week. Because we now have all of our introduction to string theory, and now we can see why K-theory will appear. Because if I take my N DP brain and my M DP bar brain, then from the discussion here, we know that there are separate gauge fields on each. So this has some gauge bundle E. And this has some gauge bundle F. And not surprisingly, the annihilation process that I described, in which these annihilate to the maximal extent, really can only happen if E is equal to F. Because otherwise there's going to be something left over. And so what K-theory classifies, in fact, is equivalence classes under this process of annihilating DP brains and anti-DP brains in pairs, or for that matter, if you could start with a system that has just D brains, add these pairs, go through some larger gauge configuration, and then annihilate again. So K-theory is, again, the set of equivalence classes under brain, anti-brain creation and annihilation. And so the one thing that I want to illustrate today is how you make a DP minus 2 brain out of a DP brain and a DP bar brain, so I'll take one of each. Let me draw it this way. I have these DP brains, and I want to take a configuration which is just translationally invariant in P minus 2 direction. So there's only two interesting directions, and everything else is just, you know, tensored with the real line. So translationally invariant in P minus 2 dimensions. So I'm going to draw just two dimensions of each. Here's my DP, And here's my DP bar. I don't know why I changed their orientation from this way to this way. There's no significance there. But on this one, I'll let the gauge bundle be trivial, no gauge field. And on this one, we'll have a gauge field. So this denotes the two-form gauge field, where the integral of the two-form gauge field is 2 pi in some units, sort of a minimum quantum. And then what I mean by a minimum quantum will become clearer shortly. Now, when these annihilate, again, I say that they can't annihilate completely. And one way to see this is the following. The fact that there's this non-zero field strength here means that the corresponding vector potential is non-zero at long distance. By the way, as you can kind of guess from the picture, the fact that this gauge field is non-zero means that there is some vector potential at long distance. It's non-trivial. At long distance, a to phi is 1. Now, the tachyon, okay, we only have one of each here, so the tachyon is just a complex function. And if you think about where it came from, it's in that off-diagonal block, so it came from strings which stretched from here to here. And again, these things are supposed to be coincident. I only separated them so you can see the gauge field on this and the absence of one here, but these are really coincident. But the fact that the string has an endpoint here means it couples to this gauge field. And if you want to get to a so when T starts to roll down its hill, well, it's a complex field that has a phase. It's a complex field that has a phase. And in fact, it has to roll down in an appropriate direction because there is a term in the energy, which is the covariant derivative of T squared. And in order that this vanish, so it's square also vanish, this has to vanish. And what this means is that T has to be proportional to e to the I phi. The tachyon can roll down the potential, but it can't roll to the vacuum state in which it's a constant everywhere. It can only roll down to this topologically non-trivial configuration. So after these annihilate, the brains are gone. But if I consider this loop around where the flux used to be, the tachyon field undergoes a non-trivial phase around that, which means that in between, there has to be still some disturbance. The disturbance is that the only way you can have something which is, you know, e to the I phi at infinity and smooth everywhere is it goes through zero somewhere. And this object has another name. This is what in physics is called the Nielsen-Olsen vortex. So these two things disappear, but they leave behind both the flux. Well, they leave behind what really is a flux to. It's first of all a disturbance in the tachyon field, the zero in the tachyon field, and running down that zero is the flux that we had before. It never, in some sense, really goes away. Now, what is this leftover object? It's of dimension t minus 2. And in fact, this leftover object is a dp minus 2 brain. And one way you know this is because I told you that we had these couplings, cp plus 1 plus f2 tilde wedge cp minus 1 plus dot, dot, dot. So the fact that we had this flux means that, in fact, this dp brain actually has a dp minus 2 brain dissolved in it. And even after the dp and the dp bar vanish, the dp plus 2 brain has to remain, and there it remains. Okay, so to conclude, what are we talking about here? Well, we're talking about k of r squared, right? We have vector bundles. U1, let's see, right, U1, wait, wait, well, vector, we have vector bundles in two dimensions, and the equivalence test is under adding and subtracting. This is with compact support, by the way. And you can kind of see why in the picture, because the energetics requires that for states of finite energy, both of these things become trivial long distance. The gauge field is localized. And this is just a statement that that's the same as pi sub 1 of, u k for large enough k, which in this case is just 1, right? Pi sub 1 of u 1. Okay, so in physics language, Nielsen-Olson vortices are classified by pi sub 1 of u 1, and we've learned from, I think if I've understood what we've learned in the last few weeks, that's the same thing as k of the plane, and that's what we've got here. Okay, so there's lots more to be said, but that's for Simeon next week. Alexi.
Is there any minimal dimension for Nielsen vortex to perform simulation?
Well, it has this one always has codimensions too. It's a string in three. These things live in superconductors, right? They're real objects.
So what happens if you have two debonkers?
So you can't support this because I needed two transverse dimensions to have this flux.
So what's the meaning of E per second? So when you have a D brain, you have
an E. No, when you have a D brain and a D brain, you do. Okay, there are sort of two descriptions. It's key. If I start by describing this thing in terms of the Hilbert space, so the states of a PP bar system, T is there, and it's sitting at the bottom of the well in the end. It's just that state has all the same properties as a state that has neither of them there. You know, surprising but true. It's different descriptions of the same states. And again, it surprised me, but Sen with the string field theory has made it very precise, that you can describe empty space in lots of non-trivial ways.
If your DP brain has not created topology, how do you describe the resulting DP minus 2 brain? Is that some special submanifold? How do you determine?
Okay, good. Well, actually, the simplest question, the question I thought you might ask is, everything here is topologically maximally trivial. These are p-dimensional planes, and this is a p-2-dimensional plane. And now you can ask, suppose these have some embedding in space-time, and these have some further embedding in those. What are the constraints? And the case that I know, the case that sort of is of maximal interest is, one of the things that you're seeing here is that you can start with 9 brains. Start with the string theory. I forgot to list among the properties of string theory has 10 dimensions, but you all knew that already. 10 space-time dimensions. So in most of the constructions that you'll see next week, I think, we'll start with just 9 brains, the space-filling brains. And so that's, okay, but then the question is, what submanifolds of space-time can we carry out this construction on? And the statement is, if I understand it correctly, it has to be a spin C manifold. So first of all, okay,
believing it is spin C manifold.
Yes.
Well, how can you find some special submanifold to be a P minus 2 brain? That's a very non-trivial thing, right? So you're
data. Oh, you always say it's special. You mean special? You said special.
Special.
It says special. Oh no.
The resulting DP minus 2 brain
does not have to be on a special. No. If I should mention that lots of
any submanifold.
The question is when. Okay. Then there's a thing, a special submanifold, which is a small. Okay. Those arise if you want a configuration that has some amount of unbroken supersymmetry.
But I start in this process of annihilation. Yes. This resulting DP minus 2 brain must be somehow more special than the
You can describe, basically, right, you need to find, if you want to, by this construction, to describe the DP brain in the ends on some submanifold Y, then you've got to find, all you simply have to find is some configuration of the tachyon field which has this submanifold as its zero. And that, in fact, is what leads you to the spin C requirement. This other thing about special manifold comes from an entirely different physical question, which is that you want a configuration which preserves some amount of supersymmetry. And that's very interesting, but in some sense, as far as I know, these issues of supersymmetry are largely orthogonal to the issues of K-theory. In fact, one of the things which is the integer value, the z value charges, all are associated with supersymmetric brains in some way. The z2 valued brains that we'll get to next week are not supersymmetric. And one of the interesting things about this construction is that it enables you to describe things which are stable and simple, but not supersymmetric. So it's sort of orthogonal set of questions.
So in other words, by annihilation, you can get to any submanifold.
Any submanifold.
Inside the original DP brain.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. In spin perturbation theory, how do you imagine the concept that in the beginning we have two end of spin on P dimension on
yes.
And then the end of it has P and two dimension.
If you ask now about for the world volume action for the string itself, which is something we haven't discussed so far, then there's a potential energy for the string endpoints, and in the course of this decay process, the potential energy for these string endpoints becomes such that it goes to infinity everywhere except on the submanifold where the string ends up living. And in fact, I know this because as I was waiting for you all to come, I was reading a paper that. On the relevant tachyon part, we put it on the Martinic that talks about this a bit further and relates it to sort of known things about non-reciprocal field theories. It's an interesting subject. I mean, it's surprising that this all works, but it does work. And Justin is here. Justin, you've been doing some of these calculations with string field theory, seeing how some of the accepted properties of final state do emerge, right? So. Yes, right.
Yeah, spin and then microscopic.
Yes.
Transcription and then actually back react.
So I mean,
the baseline picture.
Yes.
The back react.
So there's so, yeah, that, yes. Yes. That's a really interesting question. I don't. You know, part of being able to talk about this is having the coupling small enough that the decay is slow enough that you can talk about it. I don't know if that's compatible with having M&M large enough that they actually distort spacetime. That would be interesting because you would have a non-extremal supergravity brain of some sort that has the mass of M plus N and the charge of M minus N. I don't know if anything to be seen there. I just don't know. Let's see.
Actually, you mentioned that tachyon condensation corresponded to hole formation. Which are you referring to?
Well, no, I'm saying that it's the same process. It's actually, there's, let's see.
So where is that then really shown?
The case where it's cleaner is where the hole can happen only in one place, which is where the deep brain. If you have a one brain and a tilted one brain, then you can show, in fact, that the obvious process of reconnection is the same thing as tachyon condensation. I think Sen did something with this. I'll try to track this down. Here it's kind of cleaner because the process can happen only in one place. Obviously what I said is a little bit approximate because what does it mean for holes to appear everywhere at once? That's why I said the statement is cleaner here. I meant it more there as saying it leads you to the same final state. Also, if you took the T-brains and the anti-T-brains, and you pull them apart, tachyon gets heavier and the process slower, and they reach a critical separation where the tachyon is massive and they're locally stable, and then the only process that can occur is the hole formation. So they're sort of more analytic continuations of one another. Then the hole formation is then you know, just like any kind of vacuum bubble theory. So it's more that they're analytic continuations of one another than the same thing.
Even if you're beyond the tachyon, where the tachyon becomes positive matter,
then you can still, by a tunneling event.
Oh, okay. That's still.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's actually a more precise way of saying what I said. The whole picture here and the text.
Sorry? That kind of suggests they're different.
Well, I think, in fact, if you're just beyond the critical distance, you can actually see the hole formation as a tunneling in the tachyon potential. It's massive near the origin.
Yeah.
I don't swear to that. I'm not sure how precise my statement was. Okay. I don't want to get too committed.
Eventually, uniform decay, where it can be looked at upon in supergravity.
In supergravity. That's still an honest question. I don't know.
It's of a non-specific, you know, I'm sorry, plug. So, let's say you don't have any topology on either of those, the brains or either brains, and they're the same. And you have a long string attached to one that goes off to infinity.
Oh, yes.
And once you let the tachyon roll down, what happens to the string endpoint?
Well, remember, actually, right, so the whole science, by the way, of brains and string ending on other things, because when this string ends here, it doesn't really end, because this thing, now I told you the fundamental string couples to a B-flux, and that to B2. And so the gauge invariance tells you that somehow it can't just end here. And so, in fact, this string continues in the brain as flux. This is electric flux, that's magnetic flux. Okay. So in fact, just as the decay leaves behind a DP minus 2 brain, it would also leave behind the remainder of your string.
A free floating string.
No. Here, to the endpoint turning into flux, when this thing's been decayed, the flux concentrates into a string.
Oh,
and so it's going to stuff. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I'm a little confused because Sylvia's question was about F strings, and F strings aren't classified by K theory, so I'm not sure actually what the precise description is. But D strings, it would be just again a K theory. Okay.